Yeah, thanks. So, right. So, for those of you who don't know me, I'm William DeRock. I'm a postdoc at UC Santa Cruz. And today I'm going to be talking about work that I'm doing with my collaborator, Jeff Drawer at UC Santa Cruz, on observing sub nanohertz gravitational waves with pulsar parameter drift. This is from a paper that Jeff and I put out about a month ago at this point. And we have some follow up work that, well, was supposed to appear on archive today. I think is looking significantly more like next week, but soon. Okay, so before we dive into the meat of the talk, I just want to provide a bit of motivation as to why trying to explore ultra-low frequency gravitational waves is really interesting. So many of you have probably seen this plot or a plot sort of like it before. It just shows the spectrum of gravitational waves, the targets in each band, and the current and proposed experiments that are going to probe that band. So at the high frequency end, you can see LIGO here. I don't know if you can see my mouse, but you can see LIGO here, which has already made a large number of discoveries of gravitational waves associated with stellar mass black hole mergers and neutron stars. And then there's advanced LIGO below that, its proposed upgrade. In the midband, there's LISA, which is an upcoming space-based interferometer. And then down in the low frequency band, so over here, pulsar timing arrays are the most sensitive probe of gravitational waves. So it's clear that through these experiments, we're really going to be sensitive to a huge chunk of the gravitational wave spectrum, a lot of orders of magnitude frequency. But what you'll notice is that there's actually kind of a fairly glaring omission, and that is below the PTA band. So there are still very attractive targets there, and yet not really any experiments or really even sort of methodologies proposed to explore it. But despite that, it's still a very, very interesting regime, as I'm going to talk a lot about. So certainly there's motivation to try to explore it. Like, there's reason to think there's stuff there that's worth looking for. And so that was one of the main motivations for the work that Jeff and I did and are still doing. We really want to try to develop methodologies to explore this interesting region of the spectrum. So with that, we can begin. The rough outline of the talk is as follows. In part one, we're going to talk about just standard PTA analysis. I'll explain what a pulsar timing array actually is, how it works, and why it's really only sensitive to frequencies above about a nanohertz. In part two, I'll discuss the sort of new methodology that we've developed to try to push below a nanohertz, still using data from pulsar timing arrays. And then finally, in part three, I'll talk a little bit about what the signals we hope to observe actually look like in the data, and then show you some of the initial results that we have from applying our technique to existing data. So we can dive into part one here, PTA analysis. Before I can really discuss pulsar timing arrays, I should probably start by just reminding you what a pulsar is. So a pulsar, put simply, is just a very rapidly rotating neutron star that produces a collimated beam of radiation. So you can see that here. This is your beam of radiation. Here's the rapidly rotating neutron star. And each time this beam points towards Earth during the rotation of the pulsar, we measure a pulse of radio waves, which I've sort of indicated here. These are these sorts of sequential pulses that our radio telescope would observe. Now, the pulsars that are used in pulsar timing analyses have periods of roughly a millisecond or so. So they're rotating 170 milliseconds out here. And therefore, these pulses are separated by, as you can see here, sort of roughly milliseconds. The reason pulsars are so useful in the context of timing is that their period is stable on very, very long time scales. So because of that, you can measure a pulsar's period to an extremely high degree of accuracy. And this makes them one of the best clocks, one of the best natural clocks in the universe, I would say. So great, we have these fantastic natural clocks sitting out there in space. What can we actually use these clocks for? Well, given the precision with which we know the rate of emission of pulses from the pulsar, since we can measure that very, very accurately, and since this is stable over long time periods, we can look for small changes in the arrival time at Earth, because that would tell us about anything that's going on between us and the pulsar that would cause for these sorts of small variations. It probably doesn't come as much of a surprise to you when I'll say that gravitational waves are something that does exactly this. So as a gravitational wave passes, it causes changes to the light travel time between free-falling objects. And as a result, it causes these variations in the arrival time from the of the pulse at Earth, even though the emission times are set, a set frequency. So I've tried to indicate that in cartoon form over here. It's harder than I thought to make gravitational waves into a cartoon, but hopefully this is indicative. And so that's the main crux of why pulsar timing is good for gravitational waves. So these small variations manifest in the data as tiny shifts in the spacing between the pulses that you observe. And then what we can look for are evidence of these small shifts, and that would indicate a gravitational wave signal that we could measure. However, so far, all I've talked about in PTA are the P and the T, so pulsars and timing. But also there's the A, so what about the array part? Well, that's sort of where the real power of this technique comes in. Gravitational waves are quadrupolar in nature, which means that the variations in arrival times of pulses across the sky are going to be correlated. This is one of the main ways that you can be really sure you're seeing a gravitational wave and not just something else. So the way that an array works is we observe tens to hundreds of different pulsars distributed all across the sky, and then can compare these little variations from each pulsar to try to extract a bona fide gravitational wave signal. So on the right hand here, I've shown a plot from the NanoGrav 11-year data release. And this is just the sky positions of all of the pulsars that they were looking at for their 11-year data release. And I should also say, NanoGrav is one of the three sort of currently operating PTA collaborations, the other two being EPTA, which is the European Pulsar Timing Array, and PPTA, which is the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array. And then there's IPTA, the International Pulsar Timing Array, which is sort of like a unified version of all of them. And I guess NanoGrav also, you all probably have heard of, just because it sort of had the claim to fame of having been the first of these to see evidence for a signal in its last data release. But we will talk more about that in a little bit. So that's the basic idea of pulsar timing arrays. They're primarily sensitive in what's known as the low frequency band, or gravitational waves with frequencies of tens to hundreds of nanohertz. Now, this happens to be a particularly interesting frequency range, as there's an expectation of astrophysical signals there that are within the reach of current sensitivity. So I want to talk a little bit about what these signals are, since I've shown you this plot a few times now, but haven't really indicated what that whole orange blob is. This signal, as most of you are very likely aware, is from supermassive black hole binaries. Okay, so at the center of most galaxies lives a 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 9 solar mass black hole. And hence, when two galaxies merge, which they do during their evolution, these black holes are going to spend a while orbiting each other until they eventually coalesce and form a bigger black hole at the center of the new galaxy. The sort of exciting thing is the fact that the best predictions right now for how frequently this should be occurring in the universe suggest that a signal produced by a sum of many of these merger events should sort of be imminently observable in PTAs. And this would mark a pretty significant discovery. I think it would be, at least in my mind, sort of just as exciting as LIGO's initial observation of stellar mass black holes, these In Spirals, because it sort of is a totally new band and it opens up a sort of new window into galactic evolution. So something I'm excited for. So one of the reasons that I particularly think it's a very interesting signal is the fact that it does speak a lot to galactic evolution. And so there are various stages that the merger goes through over time. Okay, so I'm going to talk you through them. What I have here is sort of a plot with the distance between them on the x-axis here. And so time is progressing to the right because they're getting closer and closer together over time. So in the first stage, when the black holes are still roughly greater than, let's say, roughly 10 parsecs from each other, their in spiral is just dominated by dynamical friction. So this is just due to the stars and the gas in the neighborhood of the black holes. As the black hole passes through, the stars and gas behind tend to exert more of a gravitational tug on it. This is just a gravitational effect. This is a well-known thing. So this is what dominates up to about 10 parsecs or so. But the next stage is a bit more of a mystery. So between about 10 parsecs and let's say about 0.1 parsec, it's actually not currently known what causes black holes to continue falling towards one another. So this is a long-standing puzzle in galactic evolution known as the final parsec problem. And while there's various theories that have been proposed, there's not really any consensus on why supermassive black hole mergers don't just stall out at this step and continue orbiting one another for far, far longer than is observed. So some of the ideas are that there could be another frictional mechanism that kicks in, or that actually these things do stall out until a third supermassive black hole can come and destabilize the orbit. But like I said, there's not really any consensus on what's doing this. Luckily, whatever does cause this effect, eventually they do merge. And so once the black holes are within about 0.01 parsecs of one another, their merging is entirely governed by gravitational radiation. So as the black holes orbit each other, they're going to emit gravitational waves. These carry away energy and slowly draw them closer together. And this is by far the dominant effect in those sort of final stages. So it's this emission, it's these gravitational waves that are coming off this merging pair that are what PTAs are looking for. That is the signal here, is this sort of gravitational wave emission from the supermassive black holes as they orbit each other. Now, I've been speaking about this in terms of distances, but you can also sort of rephrase this in terms of the period, or one over the period, so the frequency of the orbit. And so I've added a new axis here. And what you can see is that 1 nanohertz is kind of a special spot. It's a sweet spot at which you transition between the mysterious final parsec phase and the very well understood GW dominated phase. So as I've mentioned before, conventional PTA analyses are really only sensitive to frequencies above about a nanohertz, which means they're fully able to characterize that last stage of merging, which is awesome. But they really can't speak much to the final parsec problem. So if you could, however, push below the nanohertz edge and start probing sub-nanohertz signals, a new window to address this question opens up, which I think is really exciting. Now, I've said this a few times, that they can't really go below a nanohertz. And you might be wondering to yourself, you know, why is there such a sharp division here? Why do I keep saying that? Why can't conventional PTA analysis just sort of go lower? So in order to understand that, I think it's worth talking through sort of how PTA analysis is done at a slightly more detailed level. But what I'll say is it's still going to be a very schematic overview of this process, which in reality is, as I've learned, extremely complicated and very impressive to me, I have to say, if at times a little bit arcane. But I've tried to simplify it as best as possible to extract the pieces that are relevant for this discussion. So the first step you already know. We point our radio telescopes at a pulsar and we're going to record the pulses. So we turn these into what are known as times of arrival, or TOAs. So these are labeled by N in the image I have over here, where each one of these is a time of arrival, okay? Now, I should issue the caveat for anybody who's in a PTA collaboration who might be in the audience. You know, this is already not quite true, as there's another step in which we fold multiple pulses into one that gets labeled by a single TOA to increase sort of the signal to noise. But for the sake of pedagogy, let's just pretend that what I've said is how it works. We just label these pulses as they come in. So step two, and this is an important one, is to fit a pulsar timing model to the times of arrival, okay? Now, this is an analytic model that's intended to capture effects like the intrinsic pulsar spin down and can be used to predict when each pulse should arrive. You could just plug in a time and this would tell you, or a pulse number, and this would tell you the time that you should be seeing it. Now, these models usually have of order, let's say 10 to 20 parameters, but they always include things like P dot, okay? So P, you're gonna see a lot of P's in this talk. So P here is the period of the pulsar. Like we said, this is of order millisecond. And P dot is one time derivative of it. This is the spin down rate of the pulsar. When included in the model, P dot, for example, just induces a lengthening in the arrival times as the pulsar spins down. And so because of that, you see sort of like a deterministic trend in the data. And this is what you're trying to fit for with the sort of gray curve that I've indicated. Now, step three is to subtract whatever your best fitting model was from your data and produce what are called residuals, okay? These residuals are indicated in orange here. These residuals are the actual data used in any conventional PTA analysis. This is what they care about, are the residuals. Because in step four, once you have these residuals, you can look for correlations in them. And so you can sort of think of this as taking a Fourier transform of them and looking for a particular non-white spectrum, right? So in the case of supermassive black hole binaries, for example, the frequencies fall off with a power law. I think it's two-thirds, goes to two-thirds. And so if you observe correlations that are consistent with this, you can start making claims about having observed gravitational waves, which at that point would be step five, I think would be very likely a Nobel Prize. And if I were a betting man, I'd say in the next few years, there might be a Nobel Prize awarded to one of these PTA collaborations or all of them for making one of these sort of initial observations. So it's a really exciting time to be working in it. But yeah, let's go back to step four for a second. So what did you actually do here? Well, you pretty much took a discrete Fourier transform. But what that means is that you're only sensitive to frequencies above 1 over t, where t, this capital T here, is the total observation time of the PTA. So at this point, PTAs have data going back no more than 30 years. And so for anybody who can do quick math in their head in the audience, what is 1 over 30 years? I'll spare you, it's a nanohertz. And so that's exactly why those curves I showed you in the first slides cut off so dramatically at that frequency. It's because of this technique, they're really only sensitive to anything with periods shorter than that, frequencies higher than that. So the big issue, and what you're always going to hear, is that any signal with a frequency less than that is what's called fit away, all right? It's been fit away. It means it looks basically deterministic on the time scales of the pulsar timing array. And so when you find this best fit during step two, when you perform your fit, its contributions to the data, the signal's contributions to the data are just absorbed into that and are therefore not present in the residuals. And so just to make the picture clear here, you end up with these PTA curves that look like this. Just this dramatic cutoff at a nanohertz. And so the conventional lore, just to summarize, would tell you, it would tell you that there's no way to probe signals at ultra low frequencies. And you know, I could stop my talk here and say, well, it's impossible. But that's not really true. All it means when you say that something's been fit away is that you need a different approach to try to extract it. And so this new approach is going to be the topic of the next section. So now we're moving into part two, in which I'm going to discuss how to extract a sub-period signal from pulsar timing data. If I can summarize the entire idea in one sort of brief phrase, one key insight, it's this. When ultra-low frequency signals are said to be fit away, they don't just disappear. Instead, that information from that signal is simply stored in the parameter estimates of the model instead of in the residuals. So it's not lost, it just now requires a much different strategy to try to pull out. And that's sort of the big takeaway here is that yes, it's not in the residuals. However, it's still there and it's in the parameters. So we can consider an example of this just to make it a bit more concrete. I mentioned this parameter earlier, P dot, the parameter in the model that was intended to capture the effects of intrinsic pulsar spin down. But I need to make something extremely clear. And this is another sort of major takeaway here. When you run your fitting procedure, when you turn the crank on Tempo 2 or Enterprise or any of these things, and it spits out a P dot, which I'm going to denote as P dot obs for observed, this is not the intrinsic spin down at the pulsar. And it's not even trying to estimate that contribution. That contribution is absolutely in there, but it also contains several other effects, which I'll discuss. So you can sort of see in this diagram that I've included to the side here, you see that for this P dot observed, so this is what you actually get out of turning the crank on your fit, there's absolutely this first contribution in there, which is the intrinsic pulsar spin down, which is sort of nominally what this thing was supposed to capture. And it does capture it, it's in there. However, there are also these kinematic contributions and galactic contributions. I'll discuss these in a lot more detail in a bit. And then finally, a gravitational wave, an ultra low frequency gravitational wave, can also induce a shift in P dot. And that's what we want to be able to pull out. So in order to do this, what we would ideally be able to do is independently measure these three, subtract their contributions out from whatever our fit gave us, then be left with some estimate of what this leftover AGW piece is. Unfortunately, there's not really a way to do that with P dot because the intrinsic contribution can't be measured independently. So there's not really a good way of performing this subtraction. And so once again, it sort of seems like we've reached a dead end. Except, as I said at the beginning, you know, there's a lot of parameters in these models. P dot is not the only parameter. And as it turns out, there are other parameters in the model for which the non-gravitational wave contributions can be independently measured, and then the subtraction can be performed. So the two most sensitive of these parameters are PB dot, which is the time derivative of the binary period. So this only applies to pulsars that are in binary systems. But that's true for, I think, 60% or so of pulsars, so it's not a huge hit. And then P double dot, which is just the second derivative of the spin period. So I'll discuss each of these in turn to sort of showcase their relative strengths. We can start with PB dot, which is the time derivative of the binary period. Like I said, and I keep trying to make it clear, you know, this is a change in a binary period. It's a binary system. It's what the B there is for. Now, a single time derivative of a period is equivalent in the data to looking like an additional apparent sort of line of sight acceleration between the Earth and the pulsar. So what you're going to hear me say is that either the PB dot analysis or the acceleration analysis, I'm using those interchangeably because that's really what the effect is. There are three contributions to the observed value of PB dot, plus whatever the potential contribution from a very ultra-low frequency gravitational wave would be. The first is the intrinsic contribution due to gravitational radiation here. And so this is exactly the same process that we talked about with the supermassive black holes. But I want to be
extremely clear here, because people have been confused before, these are not the gravitational waves that we're looking for. Yes, pulsar binaries also emit gravitational radiation, but this is at frequencies that are of order the orbital period of the pulsar, which is more like days, and so way higher frequencies than the stuff we're looking for. We're interested in the radiation from the supermassive black hole binaries that might be passing by, okay? So for us, all that matters is that this gravitational radiation causes the orbit to slow, which manifests as a contribution to the observed PB dot. Now, the nice thing is the physics here is just run-of-the-mill GR. So you can directly calculate the magnitude of this contribution, and the resulting formula is shown here on the right. Now, since we already have measurements of the masses and eccentricity from the system, from its Shapiro and Einstein delays, we can just plug those into the formula and extract an independent estimate of PB dot GR. Now, I should note that that's in contrast to P dot, which the intrinsic spin down there, which was driven by its internal magnetic field, couldn't be independently estimated. And so that's the main reason why P dot is a pretty good choice of parameter to use, while P dot really, really isn't. So yeah, PB dot good, P dot rough. Now we can move on to the second term. This is the so-called Shklovsky effect, named after Shklovsky, who was the one who discovered it and characterized it. It's a kinematic effect associated with proper motion of the pulsar on the sky. So it's basically like a transverse redshifting of the emission rate, which I've sort of tried to indicate here. And what it ends up looking like is an apparent decrease in PB in the binary period. So again, it's going to contribute to PB dot. Now, this too can just be estimated given a measurement of the Earth pulsar distance and of the proper motion on the sky, which we have from things like VLBI and astrometry. So once again, you can estimate this and you can subtract it off. Now, finally, there's sort of a possible contribution from the large scale gravitational potential of the Milky Way. Pulsars are obviously going to be accelerated sort of towards the galactic disk because there's a lot of mass there. And as I said, PB dot is degenerate with accelerations. So this would show up in PB dot. And so you can estimate this with a model of the Milky Way and a measurement of the pulsar's galactic position. But what I'll say is that at the end of the day, this contribution really rarely matters. It's well subdominant to the other two effects for the majority of pulsars. But it's sort of a fun fact. There was a group at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton that basically did the entire analysis that I'm describing of measuring PB dot observed, subtracting off the GR, the Shklovsky contributions, but they stopped there and they tried to use what was left over to look for evidence of the Milky Way acceleration. And like I said, you know, sort of twiddle it and it's very small. So kind of unsurprisingly, they got a very, very weak bound, but I have to shout them out because this was sort of one of the first things that got Jeff and I thinking about this. So this whole idea, this technique sort of in some sense stemmed from the acceleration analysis.
Can I ask something actually about that?
Sure.
Okay. So besides the gravitational contribution from the galaxy, are there also propagation effects you have to worry about?
Yeah. These are all folded into the fit though. Like dispersion measure and that sort of thing.
Right, because if they evolve over time.
Yeah. But these are all encapsulated in the fit. Those are the dispersion measures and such are well characterized and have independent probes as well. So the PTA collaborations do a very, very good job of characterizing those.
Okay, so you guys use like the frequency dependence to get the dispersion measure?
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's fit enough to measure its time dependence, you're saying.
Sorry, I kind of missed what you said there.
The DMs are measured well enough to also measure their time dependence. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, I'll admit I am not totally sure exactly how the dispersion measures work. I know that you use the frequency dependence and that it goes through one of the preliminary sets of fits, and that they pull out the dispersion measure ahead of time and then this gets subtracted off. The rigorous details of the dispersion measure fit, I'm not totally sure of, but yeah, it seems to be very well understood. It hasn't been a problem for, you know, any of these acceleration analyses, for example.
Okay, all right, thanks.
Good, so that covers the contributions to PVDOT. And we've seen that we can subtract them off, and so we can try to measure that AGW there from a gravitational wave. Now, the case of P double dot, which is the other parameter, this is that sort of second derivative of the pulsar spin down, is actually even simpler. You can show pretty easily that all of those contributions I just talked to are well below the current observational uncertainty on P double dot. So gravitational waves, these ultra low frequency gravitational waves, would really be the only thing that would pull the observed value away from being consistent with zero. You can sort of see this over here, where even Shklovsky at its best is still, you know, two orders of magnitude or so below the observational uncertainty right now. So as I said before, PB dot can be recast as an apparent line of sight acceleration because it was one time derivative. P double dot, on the other hand, since it's two time derivatives, can be recast as a line of sight jerk. So you might hear me say, you know, the jerk analysis. And for that, I mean P double dot. So acceleration analysis, jerk analysis. I also made a strong case for the paper being called ultra low frequency gravitational waves or jerks, but it was overruled by Jeff, unfortunately. Now, I want to take a brief historical aside here in case you think we just pulled this whole idea of using pulsar parameters out of nowhere. So we didn't actually know any of this when we started. But there's a really long history to this idea, going all the way back to a year after the first millisecond pulsar was ever observed. So 1982, we observe our first millisecond pulsar. 1983, Bertotti and Carr, in their seminal paper describing the sort of at the time crazy idea of using pulsar timing for multiple pulsars to look for gravitational waves, like, and that paper would sort of become the basis of the PTA program for the next 40 years. In that paper, they actually even bring up this idea sort of as a sidebar, as something else one could consider doing to try to get to lower frequencies. But then the idea sort of disappeared into the sands of time until it resurfaced about a year after EPTA. So one of those three PTA collaborations turned on. And so in the sort of 1997 to 2001, a little extra leftover paper in 2004, there was a researcher named Kopaykin who sort of discussed Bertotti's idea in more detail and tried to apply it to the existing, at the time, very limited data, something like four pulsars and 3 years of data, and produced sort of unsurprisingly very, very weak constraints. So fast forward again, and now we actually have 30 years of data and hundreds of pulsars instead of four. So recently, over the past few years, there was a group led by Kumamoto who have tried to look for ultra-low frequency gravitational waves. Unfortunately, they kind of shot themselves in the foot because they chose to look at PDOT. And we've already discussed that PDOT is a really bad choice to look at. So their ultimate sensitivity was also pretty weak. And then finally, in the last year, Jeff and I have picked up this torch and developed these ideas even further, trying to identify good parameters and have been able to use sort of the existing data to probe astrophysically relevant sensitivities for the first time since Bertotti and Carr first said, that would be an interesting thing to try to do. So we didn't really know any of this going in, but I think it's sort of a nice little picture here of 40 years of people thinking about it. And finally, we have enough data to try to make it happen. Now, you might have noticed I just teased you a little bit as I was discussing that, because I said that, we applied this and have results. And so you might be eager to see these results. But first, I actually want to talk a little bit more about what the signals look like at ultra low frequencies. So there are two main classes of signals that we talk about when we talk about PTA analysis. These are continuous and stochastic signals. So a single supermassive black hole binary
is a great example of a continuous signal. At the frequencies we're interested in, it's basically a sinusoidal variation in the path length. It's got it's a coherent source, and it's got a very well-defined waveform. And so, again, I've sort of tried to indicate this in a cartoonish fashion here, where you have, you know, your supermassive black hole merger, and it's coherently just giving you this one continuous source in the sky. I should also say that the amplitude of a gravitational wave, for those of you who might not be super familiar with this, is measured in terms of what's called a strain, which is this H that you're going to see popping up over and over again. That's basically like a relative change in path length, and it's sort of a proxy for a line of sight velocity in the language I was using previously. So it's going to require taking derivatives of the waveform in order to pull out an acceleration and a jerk, for example. So that's a continuous source or a coherent source. I might use those interchangeably as well. A stochastic signal is a little bit different, at least at high frequencies. So the stochastic signal results from the sum of SMBH mergers going on all over the universe. They add incoherently. So at high frequencies, you end up with what looks like a random signal with a well-defined power spectrum. And again, I've tried to indicate that here, where you have these different mergers going on. They've got different frequencies and they've got different phases. So if you add up, you know, an infinitude of these, you end up with something that looks like this, which is just sort of stochastic noise. And then you can characterize in that noise what the distribution of frequencies is. But this is not the case at ultra-low frequencies, actually. And this is sort of an important point here. Rather, the resulting waveform after doing the incoherent sum is just another sinusoid, at least a portion of it, at the time scales we care about. So yes, the phase and the amplitude are randomly distributed. But in some sense, it sort of just looks like a continuous signal all over again. And you know, I said randomly distributed, but I should be very clear here. When I say randomly distributed, I actually mean sort of over universes. But we live in one universe, so you get one draw from the hat at every frequency. There's just a set amplitude and phase at every frequency. But that draw came from a random distribution. So, okay, you just have this random sinusoid, and now it looks like you have a coherent source. However, there's one other interesting effect worth noting, which is that the two polarizations of this resulting wave are independent of one another. So they get pulled separately. You both get a draw for the plus polarization and the cross polarization. So what that means is that there's no sort of a priori reason for them to cancel each other out, which is sort of interesting because it means that an incoherent sum of unpolarized sources at these ultra, ultra low frequencies, where you're only looking for portions of the period, looks effectively polarized. So it's sort of a big difference from the stochastic signal at high frequencies. Another big difference is what the cross-sky correlations look like for the stochastic signal. At high frequencies, you get what I think many of you are probably familiar with, this famous Hellings-Endowne curve that describes the degree of correlation expected between the stochastic noise for different pulsars, just based on the angle between them in the sky. At ultra-low frequencies, since the signal just looks like a continuous source, the correlations on the sky follow this characteristic quadrupolar pattern function. So this is the same sort of pattern function as you would see just for a continuous source. Now, in both cases, however, I should note that these angular correlations are really, really useful, right? They provide a key way of discriminating any potential signal from other uncorrelated backgrounds. So it's a really nice tool to sort of be able to pivot on in order to make sure that what you're seeing is actually gravitational waves. So now that we've discussed what the signal at ultra low frequencies looks like, we're in a position to finally talk about the data that we used. So for the two different parameters of interest, we have P double dot and PB dot to remind you here, jerk and acceleration respectively. We've used two different pulsar samples that appear in the literature. And I'm showing you just on the right here, these are the 10 most sensitive pulsars from each of the data sets. So here's the PB dot analysis, here's the P double dot analysis. And in both cases, the pulsars were pre-selected by the authors of these studies to be sort of quote unquote good pulsars for this kind of analysis. So they're not in star clusters, they don't have any wide binary companions that would induce an additional shift. And you can sort of see this quantitatively just by looking at the chi-squareds for each of the data sets, where they're pretty much consistent with zero. So there's not any large mismodeling here, any crazy outliers, anything like that. So I've given the rough numerical values here for the measurements, just to keep in the back of your mind. I'm not going to make you memorize these because I'll show them again, but we can use these to derive sort of a back of the envelope estimate of the sensitivity before plunging into doing some big crazy analysis. So given that both the continuous and stochastic signals end up adopting pretty similar functional forms at ultra low frequencies, we can just use this rough expression that I've written on the top of the slide to get a sense of the scalings here. So this shows that a passing gravitational wave induces, as I said, an apparent line of sight velocity between the Earth, subscripted with obs here, and the pulsar, subscripted with m. So this is for emission observation. You're emitting from the pulsar, observing at Earth. And we use this to pretty easily see what the scaling dependence should be. So there's two different regimes, and each of the analyses has a different scaling. So there's four different scalings here. Accelerations, as I said, require one derivative of this expression here. So because of that, you pull out one factor of f, the frequency of the gravitational wave. So your scaling looks like hf. The jerk, on the other hand, requires two, so you get hf squared. Now, this does change, though, when you get to frequencies below about 1/1 kiloparsec, because a kiloparsec is roughly the distance between the Earth and sort of the average pulsar in these data sets. So what happens there is that when you go to these very, 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 very low frequencies, the gravitational wave is shifting both the Earth and the pulsar together. And so because of that, there's sort of a cancellation between these two terms, and you have to do a Taylor expansion, you pull out one more factor of F. So in that regime, it becomes HF squared here and HF cubed here. And so you get something that looks sort of like this. Now, with these scalings derived, we can try to predict the sensitivity of this technique. So as I said before, for our data set, characteristic observed line of sight jerks were 10^-31/s² or so. And so putting this number into our scaling formula, you get a peak strain sensitivity of about 10^-14 at a nanohertz, which you'll see in my very carefully made, like highly quantitatively accurate picture over here. It's sort of just poking into the regions that might be interesting. You can do this similar analysis for the acceleration PB dot, you can do the exercise and you can see that you get about 10^-11. So you might say, well, that's, you know, not even on this plot. It's not interesting. Why would we include it? Well, there's two reasons to include PB dot, even though it appears worse at a nanohertz. First is the different frequency dependence. So this is going to die off slower. So at lower frequencies, it actually ends up winning. So you still want to keep it around. But additionally, there's something sort of more far future, which is that if you were to observe a gravitational wave signal in both parameters, you'd be able to break the HF degeneracy that you'd otherwise have, because any one of them is only sensitive to a combination of H and F. So if you had two measurements, you could measure H independently and F independently. So it's definitely worth keeping around, even if it doesn't make an appearance on this plot. Okay, so we're finally here. Here are the actual results. This is for the continuous source analysis. This was already sort of published and out there. Unlike our back of the envelope estimate, this is the full analysis, includes the cross-sky correlations, performs a log likelihood ratio test, and spits out 95% confidence limits on this. And yeah, you can see some things almost immediately, which are really nice. So first of all, it actually follows the scalings that we predicted to an extremely good degree. So you see that these are exactly the scalings we derived previously for the PB dot analysis and then for the P double dot analysis. And this, I mean, it really follows them. And you can see the turnover even occurring at 1/1 kiloparsec here as expected. Additionally, what you'll see is that the P double dot analysis matches really nicely under the current EPTA limits at high frequencies, which was not something that we put in by hand, but it sort of shows the fact that, you know, you're using this, you're using the same amount, you're using the same data, and you're using it in two different ways to sort of get comparable sensitivity. So it's nice that there's this, flow between them. And finally, on the bottom, you'll see these simulated sources in orange. These are sort of individual SMBHs. This came from a paper from 2010 where they tried to produce a realistic sample of supermassive black holes in our universe. And they're not that far away from the current sensitivity. But I should also say that in that paper, they kind of didn't know what to do about the final parsec problem and didn't really want to deal with it. So they didn't even bother to try to simulate additional sources down in this frequency band. They sort of just cut it off where they understood what was happening. So there's even potential for other stuff to be out here. And now I can show you the preliminary results for the stochastic signal, but don't screenshot this and start giving it to lots of people because these are not done yet. So in this case, we've chosen to plot in terms of capital omega here, which is just the energy fraction of the universe that's in these gravitational waves. So the fundamental scalings are basically the same. However, since we're plotting in terms of omega, it looks a little bit different here. These scalings end up producing scalings for omega that are flat and that fall off with the square. So that's why you have sort of the square fall off here and then just a flat for the PV dot analysis. And what I've also done is I've plotted the expected distribution from the stochastic SMBH background in orange. Now, the various curves here, so this one versus this one versus this one, correspond to different choices of what's called the cutoff frequency, which physically corresponds to the murky region of the final parsec problem. So understanding what happens there would influence where this falloff actually begins. And so sort of the exciting thing to note, at least in my opinion, is that these curves really only diverge in this ultra low frequency band. So hopefully this technique is going to be something that will be able to probe this question in a way that conventional analysis might not be able to. So with that, I just want to say that there is more to come. We're going to have that stochastic paper out soon, which I'm excited about. And we've actually already been speaking with researchers in the NanoGrav collaboration because they're interested in trying to incorporate our technique directly into their analysis pipeline. And what I should say is that all of the data that we use for the results I've shown you came from EPTA and PPTA analyses. So, you know, using NanoGrav data, especially this upcoming data release from this year, it could be really interesting. It could provide a sort of new glimpse into this unexplored region. So I'm really looking forward to that. And with that, I'm going to conclude just by reminding you what we talked about and leaving you with a few takeaways. In part one, we talked about conventional pulsar timing array analyses. And the main takeaway there was that the conventional lore is that a standard PTA analysis just fits away any of these deterministic signals or secular variation, as it's called. In part two, we talked about how to extract that subperiod signal. And the main takeaway there was that the low frequency behavior is just stored in the parameter estimates instead of the residuals. And then finally, in part three, we talked about how certain parameters, not all of them, but certain parameters offer sensitivity to gravitational waves in these sub-nanohertz frequencies. And yeah, I think I talked pretty fast. So I think I'll wrap it up there.
Have you looked also at other parameters like centricity, for example?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Did you look into how much eccentricity can be used also for similar, you know, similar analysis?
Oh, the fits of eccentricity?
Binary systems.
So using, for example, E as the pulsar parameter for the sensitivity?
Yeah, for binaries, yeah.
Yeah. So the issue with that is that one's actually degenerate with a bunch of other pulsar parameters. So it's kind of hard to deconvolve, but in principle, you could use it as well. I think it's going to end up giving you the same sensitivity as PBDOT, but just sort of coming from a different direction and a slightly more complicated analysis.
Yeah, but it has less, as I understand, it has less systematics. For example, you know, like the Shklovsky effect, that doesn't apply to it.
Valid.
I don't change it either. So
That's valid. And are you able to get an independent measurement of the eccentricity though? Because I thought the eccentricity just came from the data.
Well, very good, but there are not many physical effects that can change it. That's the same.
Okay, so, I mean that's sort of similar to P double dot then, where there's just not a lot of those backgrounds. So whatever you get is sort of what you get. So that's interesting. No, I don't. We never turned the crank for E.
The torques you're saying cannot apply to these binary pulsars, but I don't know many torques. End of torques. Well, tidal fields from nearby stars, or yeah, usually they're not close enough. Yeah, that's understandable.
Yeah, that's neat. That's an interesting idea.
Or some like third star or something can also generate works, right? I mean, anything.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I mean, if there's really something close by, like a member of binary, like certain member, you know, like that they see in others, like
you know, the third member might be like hundreds or thousands of AU, and then also generate work.
It does, but that's. There's a small effect, right? The linear effect is this, it will produce some acceleration, right? And that it's like usual. And yeah, there is some torque perhaps, but usually they're very much subdominant. Because you see, even galactic acceleration is small in there, apparently.
So, and keep in mind that any of those torques would be uncorrelated across the sky. So it'd be pretty hard to mistake for gravitational waves.
Except for the galaxy, I guess, but right, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a bit confused about the how do you estimate the strain in your frequency range for the supermassive binaries? The last plot that you had, actually I was confused from the beginning because I thought that the final parsec problem it was going to be solved by friction, in which case gravitational waves were going to be a subdominant effect, in which case you wouldn't have gravitational waves, in which case you wouldn't have a target. And in fact, that's what your curve shows, the curve that is more to the right. But you also have the solid line, which means that you could solve the final parsec problem, I guess, entirely with gravitational wave emission.
But that's exactly. So. The fact of the matter is we don't know what solves the final parsec problem. We're not sure if it's a gravitational process, for example, a third supermassive black hole coming in and destabilizing the orbit, or if it's something like some other frictional mechanism that we're unaware of. So because of this, this is just sort of this is indicating that you know, depending on what you think might be happening in that regime, the cutoff frequency, which is currently unknown and unmeasured, for the supermassive black hole stochastic background distribution, which I said is a power law, but where to cut that power law off, nobody knows. So these just correspond to different cutoff frequencies. And each of these would sort of be a, whatever your favorite model for the final parsec is, but there's a huge uncertainty as to where that cutoff frequency lives.
But that solid line then includes, so that solid line, of course, you cannot estimate it with the effect of the third supermassive black hole. For the solid line, you need the third supermassive black hole there, right?
So, literally all this plot is just changing the cutoff frequency because nobody knows what it is. I don't have a robust, I am not someone who's worked on the final parsec problem. I don't have a robust theoretical model that gives you whatever, you know, cutoff frequency you want. This is the range of cutoff frequencies that people believe might be true.
And so we plotted, you know, a set from the ones that people have said, oh, it could be cut off here.
So maybe like a different way to phrase this question is like taking the different cutoff frequencies, what time scales they translate to, is that like before like the merger, how long?
What time scales before the?
Yeah, so if you take the solid line with that cutoff frequency, so which corresponds to a cutoff frequency, that means that the binary merged within some time scale, right? What's that time scale? Is it
realistic? Oh, I do not have that number for you off the top of my head. I don't know if you enhance the cutoff frequency, if it speeds through the final parsec phrase, and how much that would change it. That I don't have for you.
So all he's doing just is to hold fix the amplitude at very high frequencies.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. You know. So if you, I mean, like if you don't solve the final parsec problem, the amplitude at high frequencies goes way down. Right. So he's holding that fix, which means that he's, you know, assuming that there is some solution to the final parsec problem. Right. Then he's just asking, okay, so suppose that this other process kicks in at this time scale of like 10 years or 100 years or 1,000 years, that'll then change where that power law falls off, right? That's all he's saying.
Yeah.
We just want to know that it can't all like it's all years. Well, that's just one over this frequency, right? That's the time scale where the other process besides gravitational radiation dominates.
I mean, yeah, one over the frequency here gives you the period at which this new thing kicks in, if that's what you were looking for.
Yeah. No, but like we're asking for like the time scale to merge.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. That number I don't have immediately.
Fair enough. Yeah. That time scale isn't relevant here, right?
Yeah. Actually, I'm not sure why there is cutoff, because there is, even though there is another process, there is still gravitational wave, right?
There is still gravitational waves. That's
so
right.
Why this doesn't continue? Yeah, why just we don't go straight? Why there is this cutoff?
Right. Okay. So right. You know. So if gravitational waves are the only process changing the period, right? You know that then gives you this.
Ah, this
power.
Is energetics. You're saying.
Yeah. 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 Right, exactly. Right. Okay. I mean, right. You know, the time spent at each frequency is a prediction of gravitational radiation, right? If there's some other process draining energy. Now you spend less time at that frequency.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, what's limiting your sensitivity in the PWM dot analysis, and how do you expect that to improve?
Oh, yeah, good question. So the limit there is just what the error bars on P double dot are. And that comes from how long we observe pulsars. Unfortunately, it's not due to sort of the nuances of PTA analysis. There's not some simple scaling in order to figure out, well, how much are those error bars going to shrink in the future? But you can sort of do like little twiddle estimates by just assuming a white noise background and that sort of thing. And depending on what you pick, you get that you would close this gap between about 8 years and about 27 years.
Actually, can I ask a related, very ignorant question? Isn't there an intrinsic fit all that? Why can't you have an intrinsic fit all that?
I missed that one. Can you say it again?
Why can't you have an intrinsic P double dot?
An intrinsic. So there is an intrinsic P double dot, but it's super, super, super tiny. Super tiny.
How do we know that?
We know that, I mean, just from sort of standard, like how pulsars spin down, right? Which is this magnetic braking effect. If you compute what P double dot is, which I mean, I did in one of the previous slides there, you can see, I think it's 4 or 5 orders of magnitude below the current error bars. So granted, you might not know the full details, but it's not going to be 5 orders of magnitude larger.
Why P dot is difficult?
So I guess this is based on your theoretical understanding, right? So, but, right, like this PTA or another graph, they detected some common noise source earlier, but it was not enough to claim a detection, because well, you may say it may exceed your error estimate of I don't know, positive noise or whatever noise that is. But that's not how people did it, right? So in order to claim a detection, you have to let's say show it's a tensor wave.
Right. No, exactly. That was one of the points I kept making, was the fact that the real thing, which is nice about this, is you have the cross sky correlations. So even if you see, you know, like a random one that for some reason had a very large value, which we don't, but if you did, you know, that's not going to be a gravitational wave, because that's not a correlation across the sky that looks like it's supposed to.
So here, the limit you're showing is also based on some tensor.
Yeah, this is using the pattern functions that I showed you previously.
Okay. So you're saying that this is not the same kind of pattern function as Hadley and Dunn's did? Or?
No. It looks a little bit different, because you have this, you don't have like the ergodic, you know, ergodicity that you can use to just average over things. So you get one random draw.
Okay. So another question I had is, since you're talking about 10, 20 years from now, you know, at lower frequency, there are other methods of detecting gravitational waves, right? So I guess you did not mention, for example, people have been discussing using Gaia, right? So you measure billions of stars, measure the parent position of the stars, and that could be another way of measuring low frequency gravitational waves. Have you compared the Gaia limit?
This is just with astrometry, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Do you know where the omega is for that?
I don't remember that on top of my head. Yeah.
Okay. My memory was that it was actually not much below sort of the N effective limit, but I could be misremembering. I haven't looked at it recently. That was a lot of months ago.
Okay. I just remember it could be one promising way of detecting.
Yeah, no, I think there's also proposals, if I remember correctly, using maybe quasars. I think some people wrote some papers about, and those kind of live up here near the PB dot analysis, something like that. But there've been a couple of proposals, but I don't think any of them are like, you know, wow, this is how this is what we're gonna do. Right now, it's still sort of a wild west.
Well, I guess for Gaia, like you measure the stars, I guess some people are doing it, right? Like it's
not... No. I guess, sorry, when I said we're going to do this, I meant like at high frequencies, like it's known what the best way of doing it is. At low frequencies, I would say that, yeah, there maybe are some ideas, but it's not clear, you know, that it's provably that astrometry is going to be the best.
Yeah, well. I can check the limit, I think.
Yeah, that would be worth doing. I mean, I think it would be, to your point, you know, if I'm going to be sitting around here for 20 years, twiddling my thumb, waiting to solve the final parsec problem, it would be worth knowing what Gaia is going to look like in 20 years.
Yeah, I think nowadays people don't really talk about final parsec problem. It was a problem 20 years ago.
Oh.
People were using this spherical symmetric gravitational potential, and then you had this problem of not be able to like accelerate this binary, right? This friction or the binary in spiral due to dynamical friction. But then people later on, I think in the past 20 years, people had various ideas about, right? Like you have some, I'm not expert on this, but there's some asymmetric galactic potential, and then you have stars scattered with supermassive black holes, and people have models which successfully like shrink the orbit.
There are certainly a lot of models, and they're different. And so sort of the nice thing here is they make different predictions of what the time scale should be. So the nice thing here is being able to probe that time scale. I'm not saying there's no ideas. Like there are lots of ideas. I mentioned a couple of them, but I don't think there's any general consensus on what does it.
Sure. I mean, this field is progressing, right? Like it's not like, so people are getting more and more understandings. And even in the observational perspective, gravitational wave may not be the only way of probing this. People are using, let's say, optical or the other methods trying to find those right widely separated supermassive black hole binaries. So if we get a population of those, we can also use that population to
100%. I'm sure there are, you know, there are some nice complementary approaches to try to probe this. Thank God, because I don't want to wait around for 20 years. But yeah, I think that's great. I think that the more data we have on this frequency band, the better.
Okay, cool.
Any more questions? No. Let's thank Will again.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. This was really fun. Those are some really, really good questions that I appreciated. And hopefully I will get a chance to come see you all at some point. But thanks for hosting me.